Thanks for joining us here at the Julie Chan Show, where passion meets purpose. So happy to be joined today by longtime author Frank Schaefer. Frank, so good to be with you. I love that you have the cover of your latest book, Nice and Big, right next to you.
Yeah, it's a poster size, and there it is. And I got my other one here handy if you need it, but yeah, I got it up behind you there.
You have had a very great long career. You have been in television, movies, LA, Boston, all over the country. You were born and raised in Switzerland, and you left a sort of onset stuff to become a writer a while ago, and you are 15 books in now. So clearly you found your path and what you love.
Yes.
I want to talk about your passion and where it all began for you. When you were growing up in Switzerland, what did you think you would become in life?
Well, mine is a very weird journey, Julie. It's one of a series of changes and kind of conversions and new directions. I know everybody does that in their life, but mine's particularly intense. My father became a very famous evangelical leader in the early days of the religious right, which is odd since we were living in Switzerland. He had a mission commune there where he was sort of the guru. So part one, Frank Schaefer's a kid being groomed to be the nepotistic sidekick of a leader in big time American religion who doesn't live in America, but lives in Switzerland, then gets sent to British boarding schools. The second one, which I ran away from at 15, made it all the way from the UK back to Switzerland without a passport, hiding in toilets on trains, sneaking onto a ferry boat and crossing the English Channel with a Dutch family and so forth. So that's chapter one. Chapter two, my dad becomes intensely famous. He's a friend with Gerald Ford, stays in the White House. My mom becomes one of Betty Ford's best friends. Mike Ford, the son of the president, is living in our home. Gail is babysitting my first child, Jessica, that I've had when I'm 18, because I got Jeannie, my wife, pregnant when we were 17 and 18 as teenagers. That's 52 years ago, and we're still together. So that's chapter two. Chapter three is I left my evangelical background. I left the politics and I left the religion behind, although I'm still very much of a spiritual person. So I describe myself now, fast forward, as an atheist who believes in God. I actually have a little book by that title. In other words, I believe in paradox. I believe in uncertainty. I believe that life is a journey, not a series of conclusions, and that we can grow. So that's kind of the next chapter. Then once I left the evangelical world, I had been helping my dad spread his ministry by producing, directing, writing two big documentary series that were made in the 80s, in the 70s. One was something called How Should We Then Live on Art and Culture and Philosophy from an Evangelical Point of View. And the second one, Whatever Happened to the Human Race, was with Dr. C. Everett Koop and my dad. Koop became Surgeon General under Ronald Reagan. We were very much in the whole mix of the big time American politics and Republican thing that kind of, you know, is a precursor to Donald Trump becoming president 40 years later. It's kind of when evangelicals mostly became Republicans. So that's the next chapter. I left that, and because I had a showreel, and you know, because you're living in LA, what a showreel is, I could go to an agent and I cut out all the God bits and the theology bits, and I left the nice camera work. And he said, "Oh, you know how to move a camera." And he got me over the next 8.5 years, I had four Hollywood feature film directing jobs. And they were all kind of, you know, shitty B movies. They were the only scripts I could get, medium, low budget. And I was really burning out on all that and kind of angry with myself and really hurting my relationship with my wife. And Jeannie, who's always been my wonderful go-to person through this life, said, "Listen, instead of making all this crap, why don't you write a script and tell one of the stories that you tell to our children around the kitchen table about your crazy life growing up in a mission in Switzerland?" And I did. And it became a novel called Portofino, which I told you just before this show got a 6-column across full page review in the LA Times when it came out, that helped turn it into a bestseller. And that was my first novel. And that gave me permission to keep writing. And I earned a lot less money than I had earned in the big time God business, where the real big bucks are, in case nobody knows that. But I was doing something that I loved, and that really changed my life. And that's 15 books ago. So This new book, Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, is nonfiction, but it comes out of basically folding the experiences of a lifetime into my work as a writer. So Portofino was not a biography, but it was set in a little town in Italy that my parents used to vacation in, about a kid growing up with these crazy fundamentalist parents who are trying to witness to everybody and save them on the beach for Jesus. And he just wants to be on vacation and he's kind of embarrassed. All the way through to Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, which is a nonfiction book, but it's taken me 6 years. And that comes out of my full-time childcare that I've been giving three of my youngest five grandchildren for 13 years. I have been their nanny. I have been their day and preschool along with my wife. And that has become a passion with me. So I started looking at caregiving and saying, hey, I've made movies and I've written books and I've done all this crazy stuff. And some of it I regret and some of it was wonderful, but nothing has made me more passionate and more joyful than taking care of these grandchildren. Why? So the book really has three threads in it. One is the stories about taking care of these kids and what it has done for me in terms of reparenting, a chance to do it right this time because I was away so much with my own children. Be a better father, you know, not this teenage idiot who was, you know, flailing around the first time around.
Yeah.
Second thread is a science thread, and that is that why is it that love and oxytocin and the hormonal changes in our brains, whether it's a mother breastfeeding a child or a gay parent who's just adopted a child, bonding with that child, what's going on in our brain that makes this the biggest deal there is? The next thread is a lament over our culture that puts career and money and power over others ahead of connection with people. And so it really calls us to redefine what we mean by the word success. Is success a big, sexy, fancy job, a lot of money, power over others, or is success the quality of the relationships and the caregiving that we receive and get from others? And of course, I vote for that. And I say that our evolutionary history actually prepares us to find joy in caring for others far more than in manipulating and having power over others and chasing the career. So that's the second thread in the book. And the third thread was COVID, because when it came along, I was wrapping up the first drafts of the project and went and rewrote the book, basically saying, a really weird things happened. My book calls for all of us to take a time out and say, do I really want to put career, money, power, and prestige ahead of everything? Is this working for me? Mm-hmm. COVID basically gave us all an adult time out. It essentially said, go to your room for a year and think about this. Take a deep breath. You know, you were talking about how the freeways were empty in LA. You know, the skies were clear of jet trails. The water was blue. There was such a diminishing percentage of pollution in the air that you could see the difference in outer space over our cities. So basically the timeout that I was calling for in Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet actually happened.
Yes.
And the result is that people are going back to work, but a lot of more of them want to stay home more. A lot of them have rediscovered their relationships. A lot of them are saying, hey, we're going to negotiate a new deal here. Like my son across the road. I'm not coming into work anymore. I enjoyed being home more for my kids. To hell with commuting every day. I'll find another job or you let me keep working from my home. And so that was the third thread. So that's the book. And it calls on us to put the relationships in our life ahead of everything else and basically says, look, if you want happiness, you're looking in the wrong place. If you think it's all about career and money, you've got to start paying attention to the quality of your human relationships. That's where you find joy, not because God said so, or it's moral or nice. That's how you evolve.
That's how you feed your soul.
We are caregivers. That's the book. So you got the whole sermon there. Sorry, Julie, but you unleashed you pulled the string and got the whole thing.
I love it. That was a really succinct and straight to the point. I want to ask, so as you were in the movie business and as you directed these four films and you felt like they were sort of B-list, and then you crossed over and thanks to your amazing wife, Jeannie, who you had that fabulous relationship, you still do, who sort of, you know, nudged you in another direction.
Yes.
You saw the distinct difference and you saw passion come through.
That's right.
That is how your first book became such a huge success. But what was it internally that one gave you the confidence and the push to make that jump? And then two, once you did it, You know, when your book became a bestseller, what were the ingredients that you realized helped make that happen?
Well, let's work back, and you're going to have to remind me the first part of the question. I'm pushing 70 now, so I have an excuse. I've never been able to remember anything, but what's great about getting older is you can just say, "Hey, I'm old." You know, be nice to me. I used to have to say, "Oh no, I've had a hard day. I'm tired." Now I just say, "I'm old," and I can get away with anything.
That's great.
But anyway, yeah, take the first part. What made that book a success? I hope A is the good writing, because I think I'm pretty good at this. And the second thing is that I was telling a story that was true to me. You know, the problem with the movies I was making is that, you know, they weren't true to me. I'm not, I made Headhunter. I'm not into, you know, people wearing rubber masks and chasing people with knives through the woods, sort of slasher pictures. The thing is, Portofino actually reflected my deepest personal experiences. And so there wasn't any kind of layer between the telling of the story and the truth of it. Mm-hmm. So yes, it was a work of fiction, but it was all set in places I knew. It was peopled with characters who are me or my family. It had the ring of veracity to it, and you can't fake that.
Right.
And it also was written from a perspective of love. Because though I have left the background that I came from, I adored my parents and they did the best they could. And in my memoirs, I say that, even though I would differ with them if we were arguing about things today, theology, politics, maybe. The fact of the matter is, you know, my mom scrimped and saved to take us on these vacations. And so here this family shows up in Italy in the 60s, La Dolce Vita, the era of Fellini and all this stuff going on. And, you know, they're counting their pennies and, you know, you either buy the ice cream on the beach or the slice of pizza because we can't afford both. And everybody else is eating in the restaurant, but we're having a picnic on the beach. All of that had the ring of truth to it. But the big thing that made it successful is it was written from a perspective of love. There were no enemies in the book. There was a loving portrayal, a humorous portrayal of how a child comes of age and grows apart from the family. So I would just say, and I know this sounds maudlin and Oprah-esque, but the love I actually had for the nostalgia, because there's nothing like childhood nostalgia of the warm lost memories we have, really came through. Now, your first question was what again? I told you I was going to forget.
Yeah. So the first question was the, you know, where you had confidence to leave the director job and go and pursue this writing path.
Yeah. It's
amazing that your wife nudged you to do that and was, you know, the force behind you.
Yeah.
But what made you take the leap of faith?
You know, it was really straightforward. And that is, I was about to fall over a cliff in that, you know, I was getting angrier and angrier, what I considered to be somehow that I'd lost my path. Look, we had been a big deal in the evangelical community. I'd earned lots of money. You know, I sort of knew who I was. When I left that, it's because I was feeling so hypocritical because I was essentially preaching things I did not believe anymore. And so essentially, and a pardon the language here, I don't know what you do on your program, but, you know, I can only put it this way. It was kind of, I was groomed to be an asshole by divine right, because I grew up in an environment that said men are in charge of women, boss your wife around, discipline your kids. This kind of harsh evangelical Calvinistic view of manhood, toxic. And of course, the person in the end who suffers most, aside from the people you're bullying, is you. Because I was really in love with Jeannie. I adored her. What am I doing bossing her around, making her life miserable? So I got out of the movie business, not with any confidence that I could write, but knowing that unless I made some sort of a change, you know, I was going to be pushed over an edge where I was intolerable to live with. I had to find something that I enjoyed doing and that I was passionate about. And I've always enjoyed storytelling, whether it was verbally to my kids or trying to make the scripts I was working on, rewrite them, try to make them a little better, whatever it was. And so I took a leap of faith, as it were. I didn't have an agent, nobody sort of backing it, no advance. I wrote the book complete and then went looking for an agent. And I was very lucky because the people who read it really loved it. And then Macmillan and other companies got behind it. And it became a thing, but I did not have the confidence. What I had was the desperation, and the desperation to do something with my life that made me someone that I'd want to live with instead of this frustrated jerk.
Well, you had the desperation to go find your passion, to
pursue exactly.
A passionate, authentic life.
Yes, exactly.
That's that. so beautiful. I love that you chose to write this 15th book based on your now passion, which you realize is raising these grandchildren and the relationships that you have created and poured so much love and time into over the years. In writing this book, what is something that you learned about yourself that you didn't already know going into the book?
That's a very good question. And what I learned is that my feelings, because we just talk a lot about feelings in this world, are actually backed up by science. The fact that I get this passionate attachment and joy and satisfaction and very tiring satisfaction and very difficult sometimes, but incredible satisfaction out of being a caregiver in a culture that demeans caregiving. Look what we pay teachers. Look what we pay nannies. It demeans caregiving. Look what women are told. Hey, you know, go to that big fancy career and chase it, because if you're just a mother or take time out with your kids. Look at Pete Buttigieg being mocked by right-wing talk radio and Fox television because he wanted to take parental leave with his children. You know, we live in a weird culture. The conservative people talk family values, but when it comes down to, say, taking parental leave, when it comes down to paying women equitably, when it comes down to advancing women's careers and helping them with childcare, all of a sudden it's like crickets. Everybody disappears. So what it taught me was, hey, I am finding such joy and pleasure in this. I have to re-examine my own priorities and my own definition of success. And the second thing it taught me is that I'm not some weird old white guy, you know, pushing into retirement years, who's stumbled on something that amuses him. I've tapped into the actual heartbeat of what it means to be human. And I'll just define it this way. Here's the big thing I learned. In the science I read for this book, why do we love? How do we love? Why is attachment so strong? What is parenthood? How did we evolve? The biggest single thing I found is this, Julie, and that is I had always sort of bought into the evolutionary idea that it's all about the survival of the fittest. You hear that all the time, the survival of the fittest, you the ones that push hard, the tough ones that get ahead, you know, nice guys finish last, all these kind of things.
Yeah.
But actually all the new science for the last 25 years of brain study and evolution and neurobiology has come to a completely different conclusion. And here it is. It's not the survival of the fittest. It always has been. And the only reason we are here talking today is it's always been the survival of the friendliest. It's the cooperative person who prospers. It's the cooperative community that lifts each other's burdens that survives. Julie, the only reason you're sitting here today and I'm sitting here is because someone in our ancestral history, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, as we all strolled out of Africa and dispersed across the world, someone picked up a child who had no one to take care of her and cared for that child, because we are caregivers, that they weren't related to, or you're not here and I'm not here. Because in our history, there's always going to be something in our ancestral chain that depended on the caregiving of someone at some point, otherwise we're not here. That is the story of the human race. That is why, by the way, I'm an optimist about the human race, because yes, we have huge environmental problems. Yes, we have huge racist problems. Yes, we have all sorts of barriers, but in the end, the human race, for all its anomalies and all its evil and wars and sorrow and tragedy, we are caregivers. And that is because evolution gave us a gift. And that is oxytocin, the feeling of love that we have because of our closest connections. That's the only thing we're all really addicted to. Humans can be defined as one thing. If you came from outer space and studied the human race and went back and gave a report, here's what you'd say. Humanoids are love addicts. That's the only thing we are actually addicted to. We are love addicts. And so unless that is satisfied by what we do, by who we know, by our priorities, we will not find joy. Not because the Dalai Lama said so, or it's a teaching of Jesus, but because we evolved as love addicts. Love is the gift of evolution that gives us the motivation to do this. We are all caregivers. And I'll say something, and I don't want to weird you out, but like right now, you are my caregiver because you have this show that you're doing. I've written this book.
Right.
What do caregivers and moms do with kids who take a nice picture? They don't hide them away. They put them up on the refrigerator or on a magnet so everybody in the family can see them. They say, look what little Frankie did here. It's a nice picture. You are my caregiver right now. That's the history of the human race.
Right.
That's the only reason any of us have managed to do anything. Jeannie was my caregiver. She said, don't make these shit movies that are driving you crazy and make you come home half nuts screaming at me. Do something you enjoy. I said, yeah, but how am I going to earn my living? She says, I don't care. We'll live in one room. I'd rather see you happy. So the fact of the matter was, that's caregiving, and you're my caregiver today.
Yeah.
You're giving me space to talk about my book. That's the history of the human race. And that's why the human race is going to survive, and we're going to be okay. There's going to be a lot of bumps in the road. But in the end, that caregiving will win out, because in the end, we will care for each other, and we do. And it happens every day. So on the political front, everything's a mess. On the personal front, with your neighbors and people you know, we take care of each other.
Yeah. It's what we do. You're absolutely right. I love that you have brought these ideas to the forefront, because it's so true. Because we get so stuck, right, in the politics and the negativity. Yep. But yes, we actually are a loving society, and we all do desire love, which is what I love on your book, Fall in Love.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are so many people in this world, especially through the pandemic, who are feeling so alone. Mm. And, you know, I think everybody, right, we've learned, and you've learned through your research, that the number one thing that people long for is that connection, is that love of their life. Mm-hmm. Whether, no matter how high the divorce rate is, no matter how single people are and pushing ahead in their financial success, in their businesses, people want that connection.
Yes.
So talk about why it was important for you to have this first bubble, Fall in Love.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, it's a great question. And really, it could be the only part of the title, but we put the other post-its on there, as it were, to tell the story. Look, when I say fall in love, Julie, I'm not only talking about romantic love, although that's great. I am talking about fall in love with love itself. Fall in love with the gift of love to us, and make that the guiding principle of your life. This is not some touchy-feely Oprah-esque Dalai Lama nice sayings booklet. This is not a Hallmark card. This is the hardest edge of science there is. This is harder than neurobiology and heart attacks. There have been studies by Ruth Feldman and other people that I talk about in the book. I'll just give you one example. You know, in this thing, love is real. Okay, here's an example of how love is real and measurable. Ruth Feldman, about 27 years ago, started a series of studies in Israel and also in Princeton and here in the US on the human brain as it appertained to the bonding mechanism between women and newborn babies. She wanted to know not, hey, do moms love kids, but what's actually happening in the brain. So she's taking saliva samples and blood samples, and she's doing brain scans, and she's following this, not touchy-feely talking, how are you feeling? Forget that. What can I see scientifically? Measuring the hormonal changes, the rise in oxytocin, all this stuff. What is love? As a control for that study, because you know you always have a control group, just like in a medical situation, you have a placebo. The control group, she wanted to study how men bond with children precisely because she expected to find something different. In other words, she was trying to study the unique bond of a mother with a newborn child.
Sure.
The exact opposite happened. She found that as she sent the test results in from men's saliva and men's brain scans, who were also bonding with their children. Now, there's one caveat. They had to actually bond with the child, spend time with their little girl or their little boy, hold them, play with them as much as the primary caregiver. But when they did that, guess what? The scientific measurements came back identical. There was no difference in gender whatsoever. And so she's sitting there stunned saying, okay, let's try gay adoptive fathers that aren't even biologically related to the child. The same thing happened. If the father was paying attention, they had the same bonding elements in their hormonal level, in their blood pressure, in their brain scans, as a mother breastfeeding a newborn child. And it blew her mind, and it became a huge study. And so basically what it showed is, hey, listen, caregiving is not a female activity. It is a human activity.
Right.
You might have a social construct that says in our culture, the guy all goes to work, the woman stays home, as was, say, happening in America 50, 60 years ago. But this is not normal. What's normal is actually what Jeannie and me were doing. My son lives nearby. Who else is going to take care of the grandparents are here? Of course, we're going to help out. I want my daughter-in-law to have a good career. She's starting out. I'm winding up. I have time. This is how it actually rolls. Why do I get so much pleasure? Because Ruth Feldman has shown that as a, I can be a 70-year-old white, you know, okay, boomer old white guy, but nevertheless, here I am with these kids having a primal experience that comes right out of the heartland of the evolutionary experience. So what my book does is essentially lays out the emotional impact of love, because I'm a storyteller, what I would do with my grandchildren, what it means to me. But then it gives the reasons for why this is happening to me. And then it goes a step further. And I'm looking at my readers saying, listen, I made a lot of mistakes in the past. I'm not writing this book from some hubristic point of view of, hey, follow me, I'm so great. It's the opposite. It's I screwed up a lot of stuff. And I'm telling you what I learned from that. And here's the science that backs it up and shows you why I'm so much happier now that I'm putting other people in my life first. And in fact, weirdly, the book says be happy. The way you find happiness is by not looking for it. The way you find happiness, and this is scientific as well, is by trying to make the people around you who are, you are caring for happy. They've done studies, for instance, on the reaction in terms of brain activity of someone feeling pleasure because they bought something they finally wanted. You finally got this Mercedes SL300 antique car. You've always wanted it. The measurable pleasure in brain activity lasts less than 10 days. Okay? And the same when you get a big raise or any material gain.
Yeah.
All right? The brain activity measurement in pleasure up to 10 years later after an act of altruism, paying for that lady's groceries in the checkout line because she didn't have her wallet and she looked, she didn't have any money and she's got a cart full of diapers and you just pay for it. The pleasure that lasts in your brain and the neural pathways that can be reactivated by that memory last 10 years and longer. The pleasure from buying that new Mercedes SL300, you know, because you're a billionaire and get whatever you want, lasted 10 days or less. They've studied it. So by reaching out and caring for people, we actually find the happiness quicker than when, I know this sounds weird, we look for happiness.
Right.
I mean, just a funny aside, I don't know how you are, Julie, but some of my worst times in my life is when I've been trying the hardest to have a good time. Hey, we paid for this vacation. It's so expensive. We got to make this count.
Right.
Swimming pool's not where I thought it would be. This is awful. The kids hate this place. All they're doing is playing video games. You know, that's when you go to hell. The happiness is a serendipitous encounter. Like, say you and me were having this conversation. We had just met on an airplane pre-COVID. You know, we don't have masks and they let us sit together and there's nothing going on. And we just get talking and have this conversation. That's where the joy would be. It's not even in the vacation you paid all the money to get to. It's in that connection. And you know that, Drew.
It's incredible. So true. I just love all the points that you brought to the forefront in this conversation. It's so great. And I love that you have chosen to write this book to really uncover and to just bring to the forefront the passion that you feel just in raising your grandkids and in those deep connections. And in some ways, kind of got a do-over, right? Because your first child came when you were only 18. And so to really see those differences in how you show up today versus how you showed up over 50 years ago is quite incredible, or less than 50 years ago. But one other thing, and I know we need to go, but I want to touch on one other thing, which is so beautiful, and that is your partnership, your relationship with Jeannie. Mm. It sounds like there is just so much love and respect there. But you tell me, what has kept that marriage so strong and so alive for all these years?
Yeah, that's a really big question. That's another book. And in a way, that is this book. I have a whole section at the end of the book of advice to people who want to make their relationships work based on what I've found. And again, the mistakes I made. The first thing is that my wife is really stubborn. She did not want our relationship to fail. She saw in me someone who was in there, but had not materialized yet. And she stuck around till he showed up and grew up. So really all credit goes to Jeannie, and I'm not being flippant. I really mean that. But I think if you look practically, what it is, is that, you know, to the degree that we made an emphasis on things, we put more into to memories than we did into stuff. So we tried to find in each other the things that gave each other pleasure and were things she liked. I'll give you an example. For her 50th birthday present, I like to construct. I build in concrete and brick and masonry and wood and all the rest of this. I built her, she went to this Boston School of Fashion Design when she was in her 40s for 3 years and graduated. And she's always loved to design clothes, make things. She's incredibly talented in that area. And I for her 50th birthday, I built her a new sewing room, an addition, put a professional sewing construction table that I built that's padded you can pin into. I watched enough documentaries on fashion with her so I understood the world she was in. The reason our marriage lasted is because, and again, I don't want this to sound like a Hallmark card, both of us found a great deal of pleasure in trying to give the other their kind of unicorn space where they could really do that thing, which made them happy. So, you know, I do all the dishes and the cooking so Jeannie can be in her sewing room. These seem like small things, but actually, I consider sexual foreplay, to just be weird about it, has as much to do with loading the dishwasher and unloading it and making sure Jeannie walks into a clean kitchen. I get up at 3 a.m. to write, and I take a break at about 4:15, and I clean the kitchen and do the dishes. And I do this all the time. It's no big deal. It takes me 15 to 20 minutes. But it means that Jeannie walks into a sparkling kitchen that says, I love you, every single morning. Conversely, I don't see dust. She vacuums the house. I hate financial stuff. I completely screwed up our finances. She took it over completely. She runs things flawlessly. She saved money. She did the right stuff. I don't even know where the checkbook is. And I can trust Jeannie completely. She takes care of it. Why? Partly because someone in our family needs to. But secondly, she knows that I literally am allergic to it. It's not fair that she has to do all that, but she takes it off my plate because she loves me. So over the years, we've had huge fights. We've had big ups and downs, you know, slamming doors, walking out. We're never coming back. But gradually, this process of having a woman who was stubborn enough to stick with this guy until he grew up, combined with the fact that we really work at giving the other space to do those things which give them real pleasure as a human being, building stuff for me, sewing for her. It's not the big stuff. It's all these little things. And then part of sexual foreplay, if you want to put it this way, is taking the burden that bugs your spouse most off their shoulders. Jeannie hates cleaning the kitchen. She doesn't enjoy cooking. Guess who does all the grocery shopping, cooks, and cleans? Me. I can't look at a page of tax forms, meet with accountants, and all this. It makes me feel allergic. It makes me feel, as a dyslexic person, because I am, as if I am drowning. So Jeannie never added it all up, said, well, I'm spending 8 hours on this and you're only doing this every morning for, you know, how's that all work? We didn't do that. It was like, how do we make each other's lives better? And honestly, you can get over almost anything if you include in what I'll call foreplay, because it is about sex too, caring for these mundane needs for the other person. It's a bigger deal than people think. So that's part of the book. I do have something about that toward the end of the book. But that's just me talking to Julie on an airplane, and I forgot we were doing an interview here. So this is just me talking here.
This is great. I love it. So great. I just love how much passion you have in everything in your life, in this entire conversation. Thank you so much.
Julie, you really have been my caregiver. I thank you.
Thank you also. Thank you everyone for watching The Julie Chan Show, where passion meets purpose. We want to hear all about your passion and your purpose in life. Thanks for joining us, Frank Schaefer.
This broadcast is brought to you by WinCheck Studios. We are an all-in-one educational platform for podcasters that revolutionizes how hosts leverage content to increase engagement with listeners, downloads, and income. We come together to focus on community, collaboration, and collective impact. For more information on how you can interact directly with our hosts, access exclusive live content with offers you can't get anywhere else from our official partners, join our purpose-driven community by visiting www.winject.com. If you're ready to build a career doing what you love, then we're ready to see you there.